Welcome to the Divided Kingdom, the evening news program of Christian commentary and a kaleidoscopic view of our culture, what's going on in the churches, what's going on in the secular culture, is judgment coming soon? So much is so important, and so many people in the mainline churches have no idea what's coming, because God cannot be ignoring everything forever. And this is Elizabeth Cuppett Caverly, and soon my colleague Lou Caverly will be joining me, and we have a lot to talk about. And if you've wondered why we had a lot of repeat programs, well, first of all, we did want you to really take notice of the change in the climate. We mean the real change. Even today, it's rather cool here in Maryland, and there could be a little more snow, I think, maybe coming to Baltimore one of these days yet. We are looking at the changes in the sun, not man's consumption of CO2, definitely not. We're looking back at the times the sun has been on its minimal activity. And we can look back to the Maunder minimum. We can then come forward to the Dalton minimum. And we can go back in 200-year cycles, so that during the days of the plague in Europe, the dark ages of Europe, there we had one of those ice ages. And then we come on up another 200 years. We have another one, another one. So the one that had the summer that really wasn't a summer in the 1800s, early 1800s, that was during the Dalton minimum. So you'll want to soon, if you missed those programs, go back to our archives. Very soon we will have our archives operating. It might be a week or two yet, but you'll be able to check at thedividedkingdom.org. Again, our website is thedividedkingdom.org. We've had a few very nice letters, a couple new listeners. We're very, very pleased to hear from you. Some of you have sent us some books, some small contributions. We're very happy that there is a remnant who understands that these are unusual times. They're not the same times we were living in even 10 years ago. And when we look at the scripture, we look at Mark 4. Just lately, the Lord had me pay attention to this again. And so Mark, really it's chapter 3 of Mark, verses 23 to, I'd say here we will look at 27, okay? And when I read it to you, think about how it applies right now to the USA. And he called them unto him, and said unto them in parables, how can Satan cast out Satan? And if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And if Satan rise up against himself and be divided, he cannot stand, but hath an end. No man can enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods, except he will first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his house. Isn't that something that we can apply right now to what's going on in America? First, we can look at the culture, the changes in the culture and the things that are happening right now. Then we're going to focus more on the church, the changes in the church. You know, it was only 1997 when Ellen DeGeneres, on her comedy show, came out, quote, came out, and we had the kiss-off, and that was Laura Dern on that coming-out episode, and a magazine who is that is reporting on it, and I guess that was Closer Magazine, says that Laura's part on the coming-out episode of Ellen was, quote, extraordinary but costly. After her on-air smooch, she wasn't offered jobs. Quote, there was certainly backlash, I guess, end of quote. Now, think about that. That's only 18 years ago. That's not even a full generation of 30 years, is it? So there was ostracism. The culture did not want to see a woman kissing a woman. This was not part of it. Now, we're coming up to see what's going on right now in all of these celebrity news bites. Nick Cannon, and if you know, he's a comedian, a rapper, and a host of MTV2's Nick Cannon Presents Wild and Out. He left his wife and he has two children. I think they're twins. They're about 4 or 5 years old. And his wife, the singer Mariah Carey, has had a lot of emotional breakdowns in the past, and people have been worried. All of these tabloids report that she's not in good shape, that she still misses her husband. So he has come out with a children's book, Aliens Ate My Homework and Other Poems. Scholastic. Oh, am I surprised? Scholastic, home of Harry Potter and all of the other wizardry, New Age types of things that are being put into the public school system at the same time Christians can't really bring their worship materials. Scholastic, for ages 7 and up, features black and white illustrations by famous street artists. Canon 34, who was born in San Diego, California, says, quote, I hope that poems in Neon Aliens will help inspire kids to want to get out a pen and paper to write or draw their own thoughts, rhymes, and stories. Isn't that noble? I wonder who's going to work with his materials with his own kids. Then we have the joke of the week. Of course, this was in CloserWeekly.com. Ellen DeGeneres said, time to give up something for Lent. Last year I was playing hide and seek with my cousin and I gave up looking. I hope she's not still hiding. You see this flippant approach? There is no fear of God. God isn't real to these people. He's just a figment of somebody's imagination. Then we have the Masters of Ceremonies in CloserWeekly.com again. Diners, drive-ins, and chapels. During the South Beach Wine and Food Festival on February 22nd, Guy Fieri, 47, officiated a mass wedding of 101 same-sex couples. Not to be outdone, Drew Carey, 56, has invited folks to come on down to the Price is Right to hold a mass wedding. The host got ordained online for the March 31st occasion. People who were alive in the 90s and died in that time would not believe this is from America, what I'm reading to you, that the changes have been this great. Then we had another little thing here, a little quote. I believe this, I'm trying to see the source of this. This is Life and Style magazine. Okay, we have... After rumors swirled that he might be departing the 50 Shades of Grey franchise, Jamie Dornan, 32, confirmed that he'll be returning alongside Dakota Johnson, 25, for the next film, 50 Shades Darker. He's also signed for the final film in the trilogy, 50 Shades Freed. I wonder, freed of what? Freed of what? So many things are going on that aren't very good. This whole thing of the 50 Shades of Grey, and of course, it broke a lot of box office records. Interestingly, it isn't even a very good movie. According to the movie critic in the Easton Star Democrat in Maryland, Greg's grade there was F. And he said that Christian Grey, and played by Jamie Dornan, one of the principal figures of 50 Shades of Grey, the Twilight fan fiction turned worldwide publishing phenomenon turned feature film, is one creepy dude, like serial killer creepy. Dexter has nothing on this guy. I have expected his, quote, playroom to be covered in plastic with a table in the middle. It makes sense when you learn Dornan portrays a serial killer on the BBC TV series The Fall. Right off the bat, Christian is weirdly intense when Anastasia Steele, Dakota Johnson, a mousy English literature major who subs for her flu-stricken journalism student roommate, Elise Mumford, to interview the young billionaire bachelor ahead of his commencement speech at their school. He's more interested in her than any of the questions he asks. Then he shows up at the hardware store where she works to buy an odd assortment of items and later fetches her from the bar when she's had a drink too many. And they go on to say at first he accompanies his stalking with warnings to stay away from him, which seems counterproductive. Then he has her sign an agreement prohibiting her from discussing their relationship with anyone. The real kicker, a multi-page contract that if Anna signs it essentially will rob her of free will and give Christian control over her in the ahem playroom and virtually every other aspect of her life, including her diet, alcohol intake, and living arrangements. So we go on to find out in this review that this female character submits to the misogynistic person in increasingly degrading ways. And, of course, a misogynist hates women and will degrade them in any way he can. So that's the big filament in the character of Christian. Isn't that a misnomer? Christian Grey. You know, Satan's having a chuckle about that, I'm sure. And now, because the movie critic, Greg Mackey, is looking at the way they act, he says that they have zero chemistry, and, you know, it's Christian's borderline sociopathic behavior and laughably bad dialogue. To put it plainly, there's nothing redeeming here, not the acting, writing, directing, or even the action scenes, during which you just feel bad for the characters, actors, and everyone on the set who had to be a part of them. And he says, I learned the book has two sequels. Oh, joy. This is certainly a movie that Lou and I aren't going to see. In real life, there's too much going on that's not good at all. Now, there was another article in Time Magazine, February 16th, about this whole movie. And the opening weekend revenue at that time was expected to be at least $45 million. And now, even in globalist magazine Time, the author, Belinda Luscombe, had to admit that, quote, the film is being released just as a legion of stories have made headlines about the sexual violence young women are prey to. On January 27th, two former Vanderbilt University football players were convicted of raping a fellow student, the latest in a string of troubling incidents at colleges. The Hunting Ground, a documentary about campus rape culture, will arrive in theaters a month after 50 Shades opens. Statistics on sexual assault in the military are raising alarms, and an ever-growing list of rich older men are being accused of sexual impropriety with women who were clearly their underlings. And I think there's a little springboard off that that we have to look at now. Actually, Lou was looking at this the other night, and this was from February 18th. Welcome to the Divided Kingdom, Lou Caverly.
Thank you. It's good to be here. This is by Mark Shields. When he was Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger was often and deliberately seen in the company of attractive actresses, including Jill St. John and Candace Bergen. Kissinger, whom nobody ever accused of being a matinee idol physically, offered this explanation for his seeming appeal to beautiful women. Quote, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac, unquote. Repeatedly, we have been told that power corrupts. Thank goodness that it is an overstatement. Power does not necessarily corrupt, but power does almost always reveal character, or its absence, in the individual who wields it. This month, in a courtroom in Lille, a city in northern France, where Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the International Monetary Fund, is charged with, quote, aggravated pimping, unquote, which carries punishment of up to 10 years in prison and $1.7 million in fines, the testimony, especially the defendants, provides the most unpretty picture of the arrogance of power and the power of arrogance. First, to be clear about French law, sex with prostitutes is not illegal, but the soliciting or procuring of prostitutes is a crime. Strauss-Kahn, a self-acknowledged master of the universe, openly admitted his active participation in group sex parties organized in his honor. Quote, I had a very hectic life with just a few outlets for recreation, and these sessions were just that, unquote. But, quote, there were only 12 parties in total, that is four per year over 3 years, unquote, when he was working tirelessly, as he reminded the court, saving the world, that's in quotes, saving the world after the global financial crisis. The case hangs in large part on whether the former IMF chief knew that the women at these group sex parties were being paid to be there. Sounding more like a little like this shocked, in quotes, piano player in a house of ill repute, Strauss-Kahn insisted, quote, "I am horrified at the practice of using prostitutes," unquote. How did he explain how all these women were willing to have sex with him? Quote, "What can I say? It's nothing to be proud of, but there have been 10 times that I have found myself in a situation where a woman threw herself at me," unquote. This dumpy 65-year-old man, the living personification of sleaze in a $5,000 suit, turns out to be a babe magnet. He wants us to believe he sees himself as some sort of French-speaking George Clooney. Sorry, but even male conceit and self-delusion do have their limits. It wasn't your charm or your aftershave, Dominique, that led to your orchestrated extramarital relations. Let's be clear. The women were not there, as they stated in court. I should say the women were there, as they stated in court, not as volunteers, and not because the guest of honor was an irresistible hunk, but because they were paid cash money to be there. The sex parties were organized because the IMF, Big Cheese, who craved them, had the power to bestow political favors. As businessman David Roquette, who helped put together these special occasions, testified, he did so for solely, quote-unquote, professional reasons. This is not a Gallic version of the Salem witch trials, but it just does show the inner ugliness of this once powerful individual who believed he was entitled to use and abuse fellow human beings in the service of his vanity and dark obsessions. He will not be missed. Again, that's by Mark Shields.
And as we go on with this kaleidoscopic view of the culture, we had a little bit of blowback, I guess. There was a poll, should Neil Patrick Harris host the Oscars again? And 61% of CloserWeekly.com's readers said no. But they were riding high before that. On Architectural Digest, there was a big cover, the power players at home with Neil Patrick Harris and David Burtka. And you got to look into their home. You got to see their two children. But, you know, not everybody is completely buying everything. Even in the celebrity world, we are looking at Time Magazine, March 30th, and we have a quote. Elton John said, "Your archaic thinking is out of step with the times, just like your fashions." Elton John, singer, criticizing Italian fashion designers Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana, who recently announced their opposition to gay adoptions. John and other celebrities announced they will boycott Dolce and Gabbana. And I say, anyone who has a lot of money, go out there and buy Dolce and Gabbana's clothes. Some of their ads are pretty interesting. They might feature two Italian grandmothers who are very, very elderly. You can see their weathered hands, and they're sitting on chairs, and then it's probably like their granddaughters, very lively girls there in pretty rather floral peasant-type dresses, but upscale fashion. And so it's kind of a nice thing. You get the idea of a family connection that these weathered grandmothers are proud of these girls, and they have passed on their heritage. Now, to the Italian family, which we know is closer than many other nationalities' families, I think that they see what the bedrock is. The bedrock comes from the Holy Scripture, from God's plan for mankind. And as we see this plan disobeyed more and more and more, we do wonder, because we made this quick rush to judgment. We suddenly decided that homosexuality was not sodomy, it was not mental illness, and it was changed in the annals of psychiatry. But only a few years later, the person who was responsible, the psychiatrist, for getting this change made, said that he had kind of repented. He didn't think that this was the case. So we have put a disorder into being a lifestyle, and we're putting children into it. Now, Lou and I do not have any kind of animosity toward so-called gay homosexual people, whether they be men or women. We really don't. They could live their lifestyle in America. I don't care. The problem now is that the churches are accepting this. The churches have betrayed God's doctrine and God's will in the creation of the world. We heard about the Presbyterian Church, didn't we, Lou?
That's right. They have voted to go along with this completely. And it's a sad day for this historic church that goes back, that they've said they'll marry them now, and that as far as we can see, they make no difference between a marriage between a man and a woman and marriage between two men, if they want to call it marriage, or two women.
And before you came, I was reading Mark chapter 3 about the divided kingdom, that this kingdom cannot stand if it's divided against itself, but that a strong man, will have to have things bound inside his house for it to fall. And that's what we're seeing. We're not invaded right now by Putin and the Russians. We aren't being under a nuclear attack. We aren't being invaded yet by the Islamic jihadists. No, we are, it's like pogo. We are the enemy. We're not strong Christians anymore. We don't have anything but moral relativism, do we, to believe in?
That's exactly right. Give up the Bible, and what is the left? You just do your own thing. Do what you want.
Like Aleister Crowley, who even massacred some of his victims, we hear. Do what thou wilt. So that whole attitude you see now is reflected on television. Things that would have made your father and mother and my father and mother aghast when they were living in the 90s. Here, again, we had a magazine reporting. Again, I'm trying to see which magazine it is. I think it probably is closer again. Anyway, they were showing pictures of Matt Lauer, and he was on television. And it was Jamie Dornan and Dakota Johnson, you see. And they were putting him in a, quote, newer outfit. Boy, they're getting into it, ribbed Ellen, 57. Ellen DeGeneres was spoofing it. Cut to Jamie, who plays Christian Grey, talking about how hard it was for Dakota to be tied up, exposed, and naked as Matt adjusted his leather straps, pulled out a whip, and dangled handcuffs in front of her. Guess Matt really does want to dominate the morning show scene. This is really disgusting. You know, even so-called feminists, even the ones who believe in right to choice, they should be upset because this is taking women way, way back, 40 years back, to being under the sadism of misogynists. It's really, really bad. Women are stupid. Women who do not follow Jesus Christ are stupid. And we can understand, too, Moore Magazine reports that there really haven't been many gains. Women are still only making 78 cents on the dollar compared to men. They're only about 4.2% of the top executives in the Fortune 500 companies. So what good did it do women to leave the home and think they were getting a lot of secular glory? Not too much, I think. Not too much. And I'm not someone who's opposed to women working. My mother was a teacher, but she did not go back to work till my younger brother was about 8 years old. So you see, there is balance in life. When you take care of your family first, there really is balance. There are some more things that are happening. Actually, when we look at this movie, 50 Shades of Grey, it did rake in over $85 million at the box office on Valentine's Day. This was according to In Touch magazine, March the 2nd. But this depraved mindset just sees things that we would once have called, completely taboo. You take one step into the darkness, and pretty soon you take three or four more, and then you don't even realize how bad it is. And that's why, as Christians, we need to examine our lives daily and ask the Lord if we have some hidden sin. We now look in Touch magazine for February 23rd, and Jenny McCarthy, who has the autistic son, I believe her son's name is Evan, and she once came out talking about the vaccines, that they had harmed her son, and then I think she was told to shut up or she wouldn't have a career. So that became a very different kind of philosophy. She changed her mind completely. And so now she was talking now. I'll just read what they have to say in Touch, and you can draw your own conclusions. Bachelor virgin is Jenny's babysitter. Apparently, Ashley from ABC's The Bachelor has a very loose definition of the word virgin. That's according to former playmate Jenny McCarthy, who revealed the reality show contestant used to babysit her son, Evan, 13. 4 months ago, she goes, I can't babysit for you anymore. Jenny said February 3rd on her Sirius XM radio show. I go, why? And she said, I'm on The Bachelor. Jenny, 42, added that the Kardashian clone dressed the same way when she babysit as she does on national TV. Cleavage, hair extensions, fake eyelashes. Then Jenny really dished, noting that her former babysitter's virginity is more of a technicality than the result of a chaste lifestyle. I talked to a guy who dated her, Jenny said. The former boyfriend claimed that Ashley had been very sexually active while withholding one particular act. She uses her virginity as a seductive tool, Jenny said, laughing, before adding she hopes her son will be the one to deflower his babysitter. Maybe they'll break their virginity together, joked Jenny. It'd be awesome. Evan scored with the Bachelor virgin. He's 13. He's 2 years away. She just needs to hold out. Until he's only 15, Jenny, we're not even going to ask. Now, we have to think about that her son was autistic. We have to think about even the magazine questioned this a little bit. You see, now that the doors are opened, we've heard others say that pedophilia will be next. Look at the North American Boy Love Association, NAMLA, and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband, closely connected with all of that. You see, we're in a very, very, very evil time. Some of the truth will get out at times, even with these high figures who are usually impervious to publicity.
Settling old scores. A new lawsuit could revive a high-profile sex case by Michael Scherer. The 13-page legal filing landed at a Florida courthouse on December 30th with a bang. As part of a lawsuit accusing the Justice Department of botching a major sex crime prosecution, attorneys Bradley Edwards and Paul Castle, a former federal judge, laid out the shocking claims of their latest client, Jane Doe number 3, who has been named elsewhere as Virginia Roberts. She said she had been kept as a teenage sex slave by the wealthy American financier Jeffrey Epstein. Castle's suit has the potential to both reopen the long-closed case and force the Justice Department to change the way it deals with crime victims during plea negotiations. In the recent filing, Roberts said Epstein arranged for her to have sex with his friend, Prince Andrew, the Queen of England's second son, and traffic her to, quote, numerous prominent American politicians, a well-known prime minister, and others, including noted Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz, one of Epstein's attorneys. Buckingham Palace strongly denied the allegations, which had first been hinted at in a civil lawsuit in 2009 and later in press reports that included a photograph of Prince Andrew with his arm around a teenage Roberts. Dershowitz declared the accusations false and libelous and vowed to seek the disbarment of Castle and Edwards. Castle and Edwards, in turn, have sued Dershowitz for defamation. A representative for Epstein dismissed the accusations as old and discredited. The truth of the claims has never been litigated before a court. That fact still motivates Castle, a victims' rights advocate and a law professor. Beginning in 2005, police and the FBI uncovered evidence that Epstein recruited an expansive network of underage girls, allegedly including Roberts, for paid sex. Prosecutors allowed Epstein to plead guilty in 2008 to two state felonies, including soliciting a minor for prostitution. He was required to register as a sex offender and sentenced to 18 months in prison, of which he served 13. As part of the deal, prosecutors agreed to try to keep the settlement details off the public record. Several of the victims, including those like Roberts, the latest settled civil lawsuits against Epstein, were bothered by the leniency of the deal. Says Cassell, or Cassell, quote, "This stinks to high heaven," unquote. Two victims sued the Justice Department for violating the 2004 Crime Victims' Rights Act, which was meant to ensure that victims are given a voice in criminal proceedings. In the December 30th filing, Roberts and another victim asked to join the case. If Cassell is successful, the lawsuit could eventually overturn the initial settlement and change the way the Justice Department handles pretrial negotiations. "It's a big case," says Meg Garvin, director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute. In filings, the Justice Department has argued that Epstein's alleged victims had no right to consultation since the case was settled before criminal charges were brought. After the lawsuit began, Attorney General Eric Holder issued new guidelines directing prosecutors to, quote, "make reasonable efforts," unquote, to make such consultations anyway. Cassell considers that a small victory, but says he hopes his case will send, and this is in quotes, will send the message that federal prosecutors can't keep victims in the dark. And that was from Time Magazine, January 19th, 2015.
And back to this movie. Again, Time was reporting on February 16th that, you know, even some of those people in the movie, the major star there, Jamie Dornan, had this to say. "I don't want my daughter to see the movie," says Dornan, whose kid was born during filming. Quote, "but I can't stop her seeing it one day. I'd do everything in my power that she doesn't, but what can I do?" Cinematographer Seamus McGarvey was initially reluctant to take on the story. "I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I wonder about the images and the stories that we send out," he says. "It wasn't the film that I wanted to do particularly." And as Christians, we have to set standards for our families, and it's very important that we would not go to see a movie like this. And some people maybe don't realize what is underneath all this. Satan has the culture of death. And we see it in the aspect of the abortions. It's really like a sacrifice of blood to the dark side, to Satan, to Lucifer. And we don't see the church is doing too much about it. But we'll be getting more into a big update on Lakeisha Wilson. You remember that story that we brought to you, how she died after the abortion. A lot of things going on there. If we don't get all that tonight, we will be getting it the next time we're on. You should be hearing this program March 25th of 2015. So March 26th, you should hear more, because we're going into depth here, more things that are going on within the church. A lot of disturbing things are going on, and it ties in with this theme that we have, the divided kingdom. God gave us the title for our program. And now, to know what's really under the philosophy of this bad movie, we see an article that appeared in, of all places, the Smithsonian Magazine, February. And this was about a descendant of the Marquis de Sade, Crimes of Passion, the Marquis de Sade, by Tony Perrottet. And there was a little subnote there. Even in the age of 50 Shades of Grey, the 18th century libertine is as shocking as ever. So I want to just give you a few excerpts from this article. the Count de Sade, the modern descendant of the Marquis de Sade, whose rabid erotic works inspired the term sadism for sexual cruelty, resides in a sunny and strikingly decorated apartment on a quiet residential street on the right bank of Paris. After pressing a buzzer neatly labeled H. de Sade, I was greeted warmly at the door by Hugues himself, an avuncular 66-year-old with a coiffed, shoulder-length mop of hair, wearing a florid Gallic ensemble of blue blazer, red pinstriped shirt, yellow trousers, and bright orange loafers. He goes on to talk about his elegant wife and how they had coffee and cake, and they were next to a table, quote, set out with copies of his ancestors' novels, including the scabrous 120 Days of Sodom, scribbled by the Marquis when he was imprisoned in the Bastille before the Revolution. The Count says he has never encountered any problems because of the once reviled Sade name. Au contraire, people are fascinated to learn that the Marquis de Sade was not a fictional figure. And they say in this article, such marketing, because they're talking about a lot of marketing going on now, that this guy has started a line of luxury goods, a kind of wine from the family's ancestral region of Provence and other things. And the article says such marketing would have been unimaginable even a few years ago. Now, again, we're bringing up what we brought up there, that the backlash after Ellen DeGeneres had her on-screen, TV screen kiss in the 1990s was such that Laura Dern couldn't get jobs. And see, till a few years ago, to hear this name, the Marquis de Sade, would bring up the horrible aspects of sadism and worse than that. But you see, now everything that was evil is good. What does the Bible say about that, Jim? And I just fell into your first name, didn't I, Lou?
That's right. It says basically what is good will be thought of as evil, and what is evil will be thought of as good. I'm paraphrasing, of course.
It's woe to them, isn't it?
That's right. Woe to them who call good evil and evil good.
Well, let's get a little bit more of this history about the Marquis de Sade. The lurid works of Donatien and Alphonse François Marquis de Sade, who lived from 1740 to 1814 and died in a mental asylum, were banned in France until 1957, and the diabolical aura around his literary output has lifted only gradually. In fact, according to Hugues, his ancestors' very existence was erased from the Sade family memory. Hugues' parents had not even heard of him until the late 1940s, when the historian Gilbert Lely turned up on their doorstep at the Condé-en-Brie Castle in the Champagne region east of Paris, looking for documents related to the author. For five generations, the Marquis name was taboo in our family, Hugues marveled. It was as if there was an omerta, conspiracy of silence, against him. The family no longer even used the title Marquis. Intrigued by Lely's tale, Hugues' excited parents, then young newlyweds, began to explore the rambling castle and soon discovered that a wall had been bricked up in the attic. When they broke through, they found a jumble of dusty valises filled with documents hidden sometime earlier by ashamed family members. The Marquis de Sade's letters, papers, even shopping lists scrawled on scraps of parchment. The letters showed Sade the man how he was a decent human being, Hugues said, how he wrote touching love letters to his wife, his two sons, his daughter. From that day on, the Sade family dedicated itself to vindicating the memory of its forgotten ancestor, mounting a crusade that coincided with the loosening of censorship in France in the 1950s. Sade's work became widely available in the rebellious 60s, and the door opened for the once disgraced Marquis to become France's most decadent cultural hero, a frenzied aristocratic libertine who is now hailed by some as a literary genius and martyr for freedom. Can you get that, listeners? C'est terrible, I would have to say. Well, anyway, while this writer here was interviewing Hugues, he watched him pull down an array of these heirlooms, the Marquis' church prayer book, original plays, and a rare volume of neurotic Salvador Dali drawings, inspired by Sade's novels, and so on. And so, you know, but Jung said this, that some of his writing is too extreme even for me. It is work of total delusion. And they talked about one of his most famous heroines, Justine, who suffers blood-curdling abuse as she travels the world, according to this writer. Now, we get into this part here, again, that shows how the world has gotten darker as the beast system grows. Quote, the Marquis de Sade's rehabilitation was all but complete last month. Paris marked the 200th anniversary of the author's death, which occurred on December 2, 1814. The secret manuscript of the 120 Days of Sodom was returned to France last April with fanfare. The Musée d'Orsay has an exhibition on Sade's influence on the visual arts, Sade attacking the sun. New editions of his writings are being issued by a prestigious publisher, and they go into this, or new biographies, Facebook pages. You see, it's just booming. But this article says that not all the commentators are flattering. Now, here's Ovid, a French actress, filmmaker, and writer, who uses a stage name, quote, Sade's work is important, but I don't accept his deification. His books were written to justify his monstrous behavior, all the sexual crimes he committed. And now the article in the magazine, the Smithsonian, goes on, while Sade was alive, censors shuddered at his accounts of rape, incest, and pedophilia, as well as his vitriolic atheism, and thousands of his books were destroyed. He remained all but unknown in the 19th century beyond a tiny band of cognoscenti, including Flaubert and Baudelaire. And they were two guys, too, that I found some things. You know, I majored in English, and I had some work in French, too, and I read poetry and I read literature, Flaubert, Baudelaire, but it's not good. It's not good. And if you really think that most of the gay men are going to just stick to their gay partners and not cruise around for young boys, you've got another thought cooking, because that was part of what I found out whenever I looked into Flaubert and Baudelaire. One of them went to Egypt, and that kind of thing happened. They picked up boys. Maybe not everybody will, but it's a part of the lifestyle. If you really look into it, you will see that it's frequent. In the early 1900s, the critic and poet Apollinaire wrote the first unabashed essays in defense of Sade. So they go on, and they talk about more of it. Now, they admired this exploration of the dark, hidden impulses of human nature. Then we come up, you see, to Oscar Wilde, and he was an English writer. So we were beginning to loosen these restraints on seeing homosexuality as a lifestyle that was aberrant and not normal. I think we had enough now of Sade. I think you have the picture, but when we get farther into all of it, the Satanism of the other people, do as thou wilt, and we get into Satanism's human sacrifice, the core of this evil is horrible. And this is the way the world is headed. It's always been evil. We know that. But some of the truth will come out even centuries later about things.
The lying nun. Vatican papers reveal the sexual liberation of a false saint, by Lev Grossman. In 1998, Pope John Paul II opened the secret archives of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, better known to you as the Inquisition, to outside researchers. The following year, German historian Hubert Wolf found something that, as they say on the Internet, will blow your mind. Wolf tells of his discovery in The Nuns of San Ambrogio, first published in 2013 in German, now available in English in a translation by Ruth Martin. What Wolf found was the paper trail of an investigation into a troubled Roman convent. It began in 1859 when a German princess, Katharina von Hohenzollern, Sigmaringen fled the convent of St. Ambrogio in a panic, claiming that she was being poisoned. She made a string of accusations, most directed at the convent's extravagantly beautiful 27-year-old novice mistress, Maria Luisa, who was widely believed to be blessed with divine ecstasies and visions, and capable of healing the sick. Even the princess testified that Maria Luisa was powerfully charismatic. Quote, "She has a very pleasant physiognomy and an almost irresistible charm, which, however, is rather more like that of a worldly person than of a virgin dedicated to God," unquote. The nuns considered Maria Luisa to be a living saint. The Inquisition usually plays the villain in these stories, but the judge here calmly and efficiently questioned witnesses and weighed evidence. What he uncovered was far stranger than the worship of a false saint. The nuns were locked in with a monster. The novice mistress was addicted to power, utterly ruthless, and sexually omnivorous. Maria Luisa was having an affair with a Jesuit priest. To cover their trysts, she produced miraculous letters from Jesus and the Virgin Mary that insisted the lovers spend time in private spiritual counseling. She also made playthings of whatever young nuns caught her eye, under the guise of some truly imaginative and extremely explicit divine injunctions. Quote, "She told me that the gifts and blessings that she had received from the Lord would be transferred to me when I touched her private parts with my hands," one nun testified. Quote, "And she then repeated the same actions on my body," unquote. If she took things too far, Maria Luisa would just say later that it was the devil in her form. If the story stopped there, Maria Luisa might come off as a sexual abuser, of which the church already has plenty. But when Maria Luisa felt threatened by a rival of possible exposure, she turned to murder. Her modus operandi was poison. She used anything toxic she could lay her hands on, including opium and ground glass. Wolfe is more scholar than writer. He lays out the facts lucidly and precisely, but stiffly and with no particular narrative flair. In places, one wonders what would have happened if, say, Laura Hillenbrand had stumbled on those papers instead of Wolfe. But even in its present form, the case history has a mesmeric power, elevated from being merely lured in that even though Maria Luisa was a likely sociopath, she was also a ferocious enemy of a patriarchal institution that denied power to women and pleasure to the body. She fought to obtain both and for a while succeeded. For the worst possible reasons in the worst possible way, she made of her stone convent a fortress inside which she was a sexually free living goddess. It didn't last. The fortress fell, the novice mistress was convicted, the convent was shut down, and all records of St. Ambrogio were suppressed or expunged. Maria Luisa died a broken woman. Her Jesuit lover was also convicted, but he served only a token sentence and went on to a distinguished career as a theologian praised by popes as a key shaper of church doctrine, including the doctrine of papal infallibility. The goddess paid for her crimes, but the patriarchy takes care of its own.
Yes, and now we said that we have to look at what's going on right now in the churches. And again, this was Time Magazine, January 26th, an article about a change of heart, supposedly. And the opening says, "From the outside, Eastlake Community Church looks like a lot of other evangelical megachurches. It boasts 13 weekly services at 6 locations in the greater Seattle area. The head pastor is a bearded hipster, and the main campus is a warehouse-turned-sanctuary where greeters serve coffee, a tattooed band rocks out beneath colored lights, and attendance swells whenever the Seahawks are not playing. On a rainy Sunday in early January, William Paul Young, the author of the evangelical bestseller, The Shack, is piped in via a pre-taped video to preach about trusting Jesus And a campus pastor prays to ask God to make their hearts open to change. It is almost enough to make you miss what is really going on at East Lake this winter. The congregation is quietly coming out as one of the first openly LGBT-affirming evangelical churches in the U.S. So they get into how this church gradually began to change. For 6 months, the church has played a short welcome video at the start of every service that includes the line, "Gay or straight here, there's no hate here." One of the pastors now sends a wedding gift on behalf of the church every time she hears that gay congregants are getting married. The church's first gay wedding took place last month. Pastor Ryan Meeks, 36, regularly preaches an unusual brand of evangelicalism that praises Jesus but steers clear of pro-America, pro-gun, and anti-gay rhetoric. A turning point came when he realized one of his staffers had been afraid to tell him she was dating a woman. "I refuse to go to a church where my friends who are gay are excluded from communion or a marriage covenant or the beauty of Christian community," he says. "It is a move of integrity for me. The message of Jesus was a message of wide inclusivity." Now, you note here that none of this is biblical. Jesus said, "Narrow is the gate," really, that the true believers would go through. But the way to destruction, paraphrasing it, was the wide gate. And for this to be a move of integrity, again, everything is opposite. Good is evil, evil is good. The magazine says East Lake's pivot is a signal that change is coming to one of the last redoubts of opposition to gay marriage in America. Mainline Protestant denominations, including Episcopalians and Presbyterians, routinely ordain gay ministers and marry gay couples. Methodist ministers are breaking rank to celebrate gay weddings. The overall public has favored gay marriage for 3 years. Now, we might argue with that, because a lot of polls, of course, may not be accurate. But the among the young people, we certainly know that they've fallen away just as the people fell away in Europe, so that all the closed churches there, the empty churches, denote how the older generation failed the next generation, and that is happening now in America. But this article does say evangelical churches and their congregations typically remain opposed, though that opposition is weakening. One reason we're on this program is to ask all of you to pray for God to help America repent. And we come to people in that lifestyle of LGBT with love in our hearts, telling them that Jesus is the only way to wholeness, and that the way to true happiness and eternal life is through accepting Jesus as one Savior when you have repented. Lou, you and I and another magazine saw pictures of a camp, and this situation was for supposedly mixed-up gendered children. And they were little boys, mostly, who were dressing like little girls. And supposedly this was beneficial to them psychologically because their parents and their peers could be there. There wasn't any heckling, no bullying. They could, quote, feel free to be themselves. And there was a little picture of them dressed in girls' clothes walking across a lawn. And when I looked at their faces, I really got the creeps. You remember?
Oh, yes. Yes, you have to wonder how much of that has been influenced by outsiders. Usually, children of the ages portrayed in those pictures would be so young, they haven't yet arrived at any kind of sexual awareness.
And what I said about their faces, when you looked, didn't you think that it looked like demonic possession?
I would have to say that it did. They did not look like the average children. We've encountered hundreds of children in our work. I did not think that these children looked normal in any way. They looked like they would, I'd have to say, demon-possessed. They really did. They just did not look like the everyday child we know.
Unhappy and strange looks. And we know that it's true in the Bible that people could be demonically possessed. Jesus cast out spirits from people, and they were made whole. And Jesus is with each one of us. If we try to refine our lives with him every day and repent, I actually have been helped personally. I had a health matter that was pulling me down all winter, and then I had other health worries that prevented me from taking care of it. And God did wonderfully for me. I had that surgery, and I had a little bit of a problem. Why I couldn't have had that surgery in an easier way the first time I went, why was there a roadblock? At first, I was a little bitter toward God because then I had to summon all my strength again and get some other ailments ready to be, healed first. But then when the day came for the surgery, I was able to find out something that I would have never found out the first time. I was able to find out about a poor woman, a Christian woman, who in the times we're living in had given all her time and her energy and her love to a job, and she was just dumped, just totally dumped, downsized, given her walking papers. And the same day, her van was all totaled. Now, had I had my way to have my surgery the day I wanted it, I would have never known about this, and I could never have written her and encouraged her. So you see, God has the warp and woof of our lives. We all intertwine with each other, and as Christians, we help each other. And the true way is to be under him, the only real peace of mind that you have, because this life is brief, and we're going to be going on to another place. And I, for one, don't want to be going to hell. There's an example here, and before I find that example, Lou, why don't you talk a little bit about the movie on TV, how it illustrates this, the Noah's Ark movie on Up. We did watch it. And talk about that youngest son who wasn't Noah's son.
Yes, we thought, we were somewhat skeptical about this movie, thinking it was kind of a TV movie, not a probably a real professional. But we were very impressed by it. It portrayed the youngest son of Noah, and I can't think of his name now, an adopted son. And this son was a good boy, but he made a trip into the nearest city with his father, with Noah. And from that point on, he was entranced and almost enslaved by this idea of the city life, the decadent life.
Yes, and he fell in with the daughter of a merchant who was somewhat of a friend to his father, Noah, but who had never become a believer in God. And so they were there smoking their hookahs, and he would sneak out night after night. So something in him changed. He went to the world. And you see, when we depart from this doctrine that God has given us in his sacred scriptures, we then convince ourselves that everything is okay, the gay lifestyle is okay. But as for me and mine, I want to follow the Lord. And at the nearing the end, as Noah got the ark built, they realized this young son, adoptive son, was missing, and Noah went to the city to try to get him. He refused. He even sort of beat up his father. And shortly afterward, when Noah said, I have to return to my wife, and the rains got harder, and it showed that boy's face, he realized, too late, the other choice he could have made. We do hope you'll tune in and that you'll write to us at Lou Caverly, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Good night.